by pleasure now introduced at the finger of his. Very well qualified, both because of his scholarship in Jewish law, as well as being senior director and excelling in the secular world field. So Rabbi Singer is really uniquely qualified to share with us his perspective of what halacha mandates from us, and halacha as well as how it reflects itself in the world. What to introduce Rabbi Singer, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm really here, as Brother Linder has invited me to give this talk today. I think that my benefit to you is not so much as being a rub who's going to review some of the salient features of the philosophies of the workplace, business ethics from the Torah point of view, and touch upon those things. Very briefly, but I think that what Rabbi Linder really wanted was for me to give you an insight into the professional workplace, and what it's like in some sense for an Orthodox Jew to be in a professional work environment, which is a non-Jewish, a for-profit, non-Jewish business money-making work environment, and because that's the exact environment I'm in. I guess I should preface the talk that I am a rug, and also early in my professional career I did get a PhD in electronic materials in the technical field, although truth be told I have not done any serious technical work per se in quite a while. I have a lot of people who are much smarter than I am doing the technical work, and I just try and stay out of their way, keep them fed, and keep them happy, and that's basically my job is primarily as a manager. But I remember there was a time when I was just leaving college, and I may be one of the only people, given my background, that's another story, another lecture, who actually got a blessing from the Rosh Yeshiva of Tel to go and get a PhD from MIT. But I did. I asked Shiloh, and Rav Schmelzer, gave me his okay. So, and basically his questions were very, very practical questions. His questions were, do you like this area? I said, yeah. And he said, do you think you could make a living at it? I said, I think so. Okay. So it's not such a difficult question. Go. So I remember that right around that time, I was dating, and I had the occasion to be in Detroit, and I had the distinct pleasure of staying with a certain Rabbi Jacobovich. And Rabbi Jacobovich, Rabbi Jay, as he is affectionately known, was a very well-known Kiruv rabbi in the Detroit area. He did a lot of outreach in the university. And in fact, as the circle closes, when my daughter was married a few years ago, Rabbi Jay had one of the brachas under the book, one of the shepherd brachas. So, it's a small world. In any case, I was staying with Rabbi Jay because I was going out with a young lady who lived in Detroit, and I had never met Rabbi Jay. So Rabbi Jay, wanted to know what my plans were. Who am I? What am I about? So I had just come from Tel, and I was going to MIT. It wasn't sort of standard resume that he'd come across. So I, being a little bit mischievous and knowing Rabbi Jay, I said, well, Rabbi Jacobovich, I do eventually want to continue learning. I look at MIT as just a way of really making a living and doing something that I can at least enjoy. The day will go by faster. And I'll get a little bit of pleasure from it. But really, my she'ifa, my goal in life is to get she'ifa, and then I'll have my PhD, and I couldn't resist it. And then I looked at Rabbi Jay, and I said, then I will be Rabbi Dr. Singer. And if you know the cultural nuances, there are some people, when you say Rabbi Dr., it makes them very, very happy. I Rabbi Jay was of the cultural affiliation that I knew there was a little bit of a, you know, a little bit of a coach. So Rabbi Jay, without missing a beat, he said, "Well, you know what they say about Rabbi doctors?" I said, "Oh, what are they saying?" He said, "If the doctor's too close to the rabbi, must mean the rabbi's not feeling well." And so I remembered that. It was very funny, and I've always kept that in a sort of a humbling sort of way. And the way I look at it is really from my vantage point, it helps me make a living. I do buy a lottery ticket every couple of months in the hope that that I can retire from this job and spend my time learning full time. So I want to go ahead and just make that caveat that that's my real goal in life. But as long as the Ribono Shel Olam has not chosen to bless me with tens of millions of dollars, and I have not won the lottery yet, so I take it as a little bit of direction from Shemayim that this is what he wants me to do. So that's it. Okay, let's go. So there are a number of topics. Yeah. What's that? Whatever you. Yeah, I don't know. People, can people see the chart? Okay. So, to give a talk like this, I think if I were to give this talk five times, it would be five different talks. Because each of these bullet items can be and represent a significant talk. And in some sense, although Rabbi Winter invited me to go ahead and speak about a month ago, I wish that I could have spent more time on this. I apologize in advance because it is such a rich topic, and it is something that really requires a great deal of eon, a great deal of analysis, both to get these halachas and get these hashkafas right, and also, of course, to present it to other people. So those are some of the things I'm going to talk about. The first two bullets, the first three bullets, I'm going to kind of move very quickly. That's not the focus of my talk. I'm assuming that I know that the Polo of Greater Washington has been doing a great deal of work in Lean and Synthetic and doing a great deal of work in business ethics in general. Some time ago, I remember I gave a talk on Gnevas Das and on honesty or deception, and I know that this is something that with which people are seriously engaged. So I don't want to go ahead and repeat what you've already been learning. So I wanted to give a sort of fresh perspective. What, from a business culture, from a business point of view, how do businesses view the issue of ethics? And what is the confluence and intersection with that and Jewish law, and how do Orthodox Jews in the workplace deal with that? Okay, so I just gave a smattering of issues of what the halakhas are, some of the halakhas that are associated with the workplace. I remember some time ago there was a mid-Atlantic halakhic conference, and this was held in Baltimore. It must have been about 10, 15 years ago. Maybe about 15 years ago, Rabbi Keller from Pels was there, Rabbi Weinberg from Salm, Rosh Hashanah from there was there, Rabbi Heinemann spoke, Rabbi Paul Hirschfeld spoke, Cleveland, and they went over a lot of the halakhas, and it was a magnificent conference, and I think that people should have such a conference again. And there are a lot of issues. You could go and look in Igros Moshe and look at the tshuvas about the propriety of wearing or not wearing a yarmulke in the workplace. How do you feel about that? What is the hearing? What is the foolish? It's an issue. I wear a yarmulke in the workplace, And since I was promoted to be director of the lab, I made a decision. I'm just going to let my beard grow until somebody tells me to trim it. And I figured that to the victor go the spoils. And as long as I'm making money, nobody's going to care. And that's really one of the themes over here that I want to get to when we talk about business ethics. There are business ethics, and they're very, very important, but there are very different goals associated with being a observant Jew who wants to ascend the sulam who wants to achieve Dveikus with the Ribono Shel Olam, wants to come to Yiras Shamayim, Avos Hashem, and wants to come to Dveikus and Halichas Bedrachos, that's a series, that's a mission, a life mission, and it has associated with it a whole series of behaviors. That's very different than the workplace, where the workplace, although work environments are concerned with business ethics, because every violation that you've read about, every scandal that you've read about in the last 20 years has precipitated and engendered a whole series of legislation, right, dictating policy, so businesses want to comply with ethical standards, but make no mistake, the purpose of a business is to make money. So if you make money, you're doing great. If you don't make money, you're not doing great. And I could walk into the CEO, and if I've overrun $20 million on a contract, and I tell him that we've overrun a contract, the company is now in the red, we have to cough up $20 million of company reserves to cover an overrun, but sir, I want you to know, I adhered to the highest ethical standards, and I did everything right. I treated everybody with courtesy. I was fully honest and open about all disclosures. It is not going to save me at all from getting a very, very serious talking to at best. Okay. So just going back, I'm sorry, Benjamin. So one of the real significant issues, and I'm not going to get into it, is shaking hands with members of the opposite sex. How does one deal with a high senior level customer who is coming to the company, who extends their hand to you and shakes their hand? What do you do? There are, of course, yichud issues associated with members of the opposite sex. If you have conversations with women in your office, and the yichud issues become more pronounced and more serious, the more comfortable and more familiar you become, one becomes with the people with whom you work. So if one feels very, you've been in the trenches together and you've faced various struggles and battles together, there's a certain familiarity that is engendered, which means that one has to be even more careful and more conscientious about the issue. Attending or even sponsoring office holiday parties. There was a question that Rick Heineman dealt with several years ago. What happens if you a Jew owns a business? Is it okay for him to have a holiday party for his Gentile employees? And the climate actually asked him that it was okay, arguing that Xmas was sort of on the level of Thanksgiving, that it had become completely secularized, and was now the holiday party was just sort of a secular event, and that it was okay for a Jew to sponsor. I personally, I wear a yarmulke at work, and I only shake hands with members of the opposite sex when I feel my job is on the line, and I'm talking about, superiors. I am very conscientious about yichud issues. The door is left ajar, and I know that my administrative assistant, she comes bursting in anytime she wants to, no matter who I happen to be talking to, so that's okay. I do not attend office holiday parties. There are issues, a lot of kashrut issues, the use of the communal kitchen facilities, use of the microwave, kashrut in the microwave, after someone else has used the microwave, and what happens if you buy your own microwave? Can you be assured of the fact that even if you put a sign on it, that this is my microwave, please don't use it? Can you be assured that people won't use it? So those are concerns, and even leaving things in the refrigerator. Right, there are halachas that are associated with leaving meat unattended. That when you have meat, it should be wrapped, it should be sealed, it should have a plumb book, right, and they have all these things. And I heard an amazing story from Rev Frand about somebody who was on an airplane, and he had a kosher meal, and he was sitting next to somebody who was not a Jew, and so what happened? He opened his meal up, and then he went to go ahead and wash his hands, and he came back to wash his hands, and he was struggling with the issue. He had learned the halacha, you're not supposed to leave meat unattended, and he opened up the package, and maybe he shouldn't have opened up the package, and He wasn't sure. And so as he sat down to go ahead and eat the meat, you know, he took a little bite of bread and he started putting the sandwich in his mouth, and then he put the sandwich down, he put it in his mouth, he put it down, am I doing right, am I doing wrong? And then he took the sandwich down. And then the Gentile who was sitting next to him turned to him and said, you know, your God is protecting you. He said, why? He said, to tell you the truth, I'll come clean. I always wanted to know what kosher meat tasted like. So I have to tell you, what I did was I took your meat and put my meat in your hand. And I just, you know, I apologize for that. So there you go. So you never know. And then another very common issue is accompanying colleagues to restaurants or bars. It's a more difficult issue, but to restaurants. Does it make a difference whether you go out to a McDonald's with and have a business meeting? A lot of business meetings, a lot of deals are sealed over dinner. And if you do go to a restaurant, you know, so again, the guidance that I received at this Middle East and Columbus conference was that it was okay to accompany people to a nice restaurant, a fancy restaurant, because everybody understood that that's where business is done. And there wasn't an Indian with Mara sign, but of course, what you eat there is something that is a very, very serious one. And then there are the other issues which now border on ethical issues of the use of company resources or time for personal business. You know, you get on the phone and you start talking to people, or you start using the fax, or you start using the copy machine, and you start using this, you start using that, you start taking the pen, you start taking the pencil, you start taking the paper, the rulers, the staplers, and everything that happens to be there that's usually in an open cabinet and is designed for company business. Where do you draw the line? And usually, companies do have policies regarding the use of phone time, and the company will typically allow for employees to make some number of personal calls a day. And I told my secretary, basically, that she could talk to whoever she wanted to talk to, but she just had to make sure that she got her work done. And that she had to be available to me at a moment's notice, that if she was in a conversation and I came into her office, that she had to go ahead and basically, you know, finish the conversation with about 2 or 3 seconds and be able to go ahead. And so we've worked that out. Okay, halachas of the world. Now, Torah values, and this is sort of my statement, so I'm not quoting anybody. This is me. The mission of an observant Jew is to serve Hashem through the study and application of the Torah. We climb Jacob's ladder, and we increase and grow in our madrigas, and we come to higher levels of fearing Hashem, loving Hashem, being close to Hashem, by an ethical conduct, and by belief of Sidraki. It's a beautiful introduction to the Sefer Tome Devorah, written by Rabbi David Goldberg, that discusses the whole premise of the Talmud Devorah, that the essence and purpose of the Jew is to walk in the ways of Hashem. This is a nuance from the Chofetz Chaim's approach, where walking in the ways of Hashem is viewed as a means to go from yira, from fear of Hashem, to love of Hashem, to closeness to Hashem, which is ultimately the purpose. So it's a nuance, but basically, if you grow in loving and fearing and being close to Hashem, and you walk in Hashem's ways, you make everybody happy. Now, here's a story that I saw from Sparks with Musa, which is a great story. And it really speaks to the issue of the halakhas of the seriousness of the halakhas of the workplace and ethical considerations of the workplace. We'll read it together. A learned, God-fearing shaykhet came to Brit Mishril Salanter and told him his wish to leave his job. He was getting old, and he was afraid that perhaps he wouldn't be able to check his knife properly, or perhaps he wouldn't be able to execute a shechita in the proper way. There's all sorts of halachas. You can't hesitate. You have to do it in the right spot, and so on and so forth. There are a lot of issues, a lot of very serious technical issues associated with doing a kosher shechita. And so he was getting older, he was afraid his hand was shaking, his eyesight was failing, and he wanted to get out of the shechita business. So the Yisrael says, well, what will you do to earn a living? So he said, we're going to open it. No problem. And indeed, the Yisro was amazed. You're worried about Shita, which involves only the one prohibition of Mazeva, of eating meat, which is not tested properly. How much more is there to worry about in a store, which involves many prohibitions, such as stealing, and all the halakhos associated with these prohibitions? Oppressing, charging too much, charging enough, whatever the issue may be, coveting, cheating, lying, keeping inaccurate measurements. There's a major section of the Shulchan Aruch that is devoted to this. And in fact, one of the Mandiyamim say that if a person wants to achieve the level of Chassidus, there's an opinion that says you should learn Pirkei Avos. There's also an opinion that says that you need to learn the halakhos of Mizik. You need to learn the halakhos of damage. You need to be an expert. You need to be a chassid. You express your piety, your devotion, and a devoted to the Kodesh Baruch Hu by being meticulous in the observance of this halakha. That's how a person achieves great levels. And in fact, when someone dies, right, they're asked, they appear before the Rabbana Shalom, and, you know, when you survey an Ethan, you set aside time for Torah study, and then one of the questions will be ethical in this case. A very important issue. So, and this is another quote from a book that I saw. Individuals have the responsibility to conduct themselves through the type of in an honest and forthright way. Organizations, even while increasing profits, need to recognize some form of corporate social responsibility. This is the Jewish perspective. So now you have the confluence of the Torah in this. So when an Orthodox Jew is placed into a work environment, not only does he or she have to adhere strictly to all of the halakhas that are associated with being and conducting business in a forthright manner, but there is another very important complication, and that is the issue of Kiddush Hashem, because you're surrounded by Gentiles. And if you're in the workplace and people can pretty much figure out that you're Jewish the first time that you don't show up for Yom Meroyim, while you're not here for Pesach, while you're leaving early for Shabbat, and most of the time the environment is sufficiently collegiate that it's not something that one hides anymore. I mean, Baruch Hashem, in this day and age, we have a whole host of problems, and anti-Semitism is not something that is relegated to the ash heap of history by any means, and certainly not in this country. But I think that if any of us were to have a conversation, have the truth of having a conversation with our grandparents and great-grandparents who had to deal with what they dealt with in Europe, it's a very different world. So we have the issue of Kiddush Hashem, and that means that whatever business ethics there are, you have to be better than that. You know, I always maintain when I go to the Giant in Potomac, I never start up with the cashier. I just never start up with the cashier. She's always right. I'm always wrong. I don't want to start up because I don't want the cashier to associate me, a yarmulke, a beard, and everything else with being contentious and difficult or cheap or this and that. Just, I'm like, fine, whatever it is. So, it's also something else that's very interesting. It just happened this past week. It's a good barometer. I was in a business meeting. I was in a meeting with a very, very important customer. This customer was the head of a major research lab from which we get a lot of funding, a government customer. And the customer was being very forthright with us, and in the course of his conversation, he used a bad word, right? He used a word that nobody should use in polite company, impolite company. No, certainly no Jew should use such a word in any level of conversation. It was a bad word, one of the worst words. Okay? And then, after he used that word, he turned to me and apologized. And he said, sorry. Okay. And I felt good. Because the day that someone uses a word like that in my presence and doesn't turn to me and apologize, is the day that I'm going to have to take a very serious look in the mirror and wondering what I have done to go ahead and compromise my own standards as people should feel comfortable using the language. That's a very important issue. Basic teachings of the Egeret and Ramban, always have to speak nice, right? It says, the Dab of Kol Karefa, B'chol Eish, that you should speak all of your words nicely at all times to all people under all circumstances. That's the Egeret and Ramban. First sentence of the Egeret and Ramban. Always speak nicely. Avoid anger, avoid harsh words, avoid Lashon Hara, avoid Nivul Peh. You have to be honest, you have to be yosher, you have to be a trustworthy person. And the intersection of what I call of Torah and Dale Carnegie, right? How to influence people, right? Dale Carnegie wrote a book on how to influence people, and they basically he talked about, you know, being, you know, dealing with Menschlichkeit and being nice, and there is definitely a very important intersection. And in the Nefesh HaChaim, Reb Chaim Volozhin, it talks about Hashem, that Hashem is like a shadow, meaning that how you behave is how Hashem presents the world to you. So if you behave in such a way that you believe in Hashem, and you see the good in the world, and you see the good in people, then Hashem will restructure the world so that the good in people, the good in the world, and His presence will be revealed to you. So it's a self-justifying perspective. This is part of the world. If you turn away from Hashem, you won't see Hashem. The Marshal was a proven. So, Dale Carnegie is a subset of that. Dale Carnegie would say, you be nice to people, you treat people with respect, they'll treat you with respect, they'll be nice to you. And that makes perfect sense. So, it's important to be kind and empathetic. It's important to show courage to the people who work for you, to the administrative assistants, to the secretaries. Always say thank you. Never take things that people do to you for granted. And if the engineers are working hard, they're getting paid, I make sure that they get bonuses. I work very hard to advocate for the people who work for me in any way, shape I can. And then another very, very important thing is part and parcel of the Kiddush Hashem paradigm is when there's a problem. And there are problems. There are always problems. There are deliveries that are not met. There are milestones that slip. There are things that go wrong, experiments that you wanted things to work out a certain way, it didn't work out. Somebody made a mistake. Somebody forgot to go ahead and turn a setting down. Somebody didn't take into account this particular problem when they were designing a system. And something failed. So what do? Do you go ahead, as some managers do, and publicly, so the customer starts screaming at the program manager or starts screaming at the director, you idiot? And then if you're not a good director, you say, oh, I'm not an idiot, sir. Or you say, yeah, I'm an idiot, and then you immediately turn to the person who made the mistake and say, you're an idiot. That's the worst thing to do. I never do that. I'm an idiot. I'm an idiot. The people who work for me, they are protected. They are not idiots. I am the idiot. It's my fault. And then, privately, we'll go calmly, we'll say, okay, what do you think we could have done? Go ahead and do this a little bit. How are we going to do it? And in exchange for that, they're very loyal. In exchange for that, they want to work for me. In exchange for that, I get the best people in the company. Because they know I'll treat them fairly. Because I'm following the dictates of the code. I'm trying as hard as I can to do what's right. I fail sometimes, but they know I try. And I try and protect them from the wrath of customers and senior management when there's a mistake. Achlokas, Lashon Hara, backstabbing, try very, very hard to create a culture where that is not accepted. And in fact, it's very interesting. I have a little parenthesis here. JF stands for Gene Floyd, a senior vice president to whom I report. And he actually got so disgusted. It's funny, I have, depending on how the ebb and flow of my life is, sometimes I feel the pressures of the religious community, the pressures of being a rav, as being overwhelming, and I go to work and just, this is a break. There are rules, there are behaviors, the people, unlike congregants, the people, you know, who I have supervisory responsibility for, I control their salary, so they listen to me a little bit more, I can give them a little muster, you know, and they're going to be okay, 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 because they know I'm giving them their performance review. So they respond, and say, this is good, there are laws, there's hierarchy, there's structure. I say, oh, work is a machai. Right? And then, of course, then you see certain things that go on in the workplace that are just astonishing. There's the treachery, sometimes the backstabbing, politics. And so I sometimes wonder, you know, that then I go back and say, oh, the community, the Rosh Hashem, everybody here is trying to do things, L'shem Shemayim, and it's really interesting to go ahead and compare the two paradigms. Is it better to deal, you know, with on the business side of it, it's like the Kutzker Rebbe once said that I'd rather deal with a Russian who knows he's a Russian than deal with a Tzaddik who knows he's a Tzaddik. Right? And so at work, you know, I sometimes deal with Rishoyim who know they're Rishoyim. But on the other hand, there's something to be said with dealing with people who have the Sheikhs and Sitkis, even though it may be misguided. But there was actually a situation where my peers in the company were all vying for our boss, a senior VP, was reassigned. He wasn't making enough money, he wasn't doing a good job, so there's a vacancy. So there's a competition about on my level of management to fill that empty spot. And so what was happening was that there was just out and out slander, lashon hara, backstabbing. Something would go wrong in a different business area, the other business area managers would start, you know, highlighting, oh, did you see this guy's incompetent and this and that. It got to the point where, and I found it was so refreshing, that the big boss of everybody sat down all the managers and said, I don't want to hear this anymore. I don't want to hear, basically what he was saying was, I don't want to hear any more Russian horror. I don't want to hear any Moshe Shema. And if anybody comes into my office and starts saying Russian horror about somebody else, I'm bringing him down to human resources, and which is the worst thing that can happen to an employee, to get dragged down to human resources, because then it gets part of the permanent record. This guy speaking Russian horror, he's an untrustworthy person. If I hear another word of it, I'm bringing you down to human resources. And that was it. And I was like, oh. It was wonderful. It was refreshing. And then there is a large overlap between good management techniques and gashrut. There's a large overlap between business ethics, even from a business perspective. There is a large overlap. It is not mutually exclusive. So, here we are. Perfect harmony. In fact, you know, so far I'm making the argument, you know, go learn coal, go work for orbital. You know, it's a wonderful thing, right? You want to grow. You know, look at this. And this comes from a letter from David Thompson, the chief executive officer. Orbital has a long-standing commitment to upholding the highest ethical and legal standards in the conduct of all of its business operations. Ethics is everyone's responsibility. Orbital's code of business conduct and ethics, which we are all obligated to read, and we all have to get tested on it every year, twice a year. We have to show that we've read it and that we're familiar with it, as well as a whole host of other ethical training that's online, that you go ahead and you do the test, and you have to score 100 on the test, and they go through all these scenarios, and quite frankly, some of the scenarios are so ambiguous, I couldn't figure out the right thing to do because they were so ambiguous. So I had to take the test over 3 times until I finally get the right answer. But this is it. And then acting with integrity is not only good policy, it's good business. Therefore, our commitment to doing the right thing must always come first. Thank you for your support and commitment. Signed, David W. Thompson, Chairman and Chief Executive Officer. And he means it. He means it. Next chart. There's a bifurcation for our business that I alluded to earlier. Social responsibility of business is to increase profit. That's what a business is. That's the mission of a business, to make money. Few trends would so thoroughly undermine the very foundations of our free society that the acceptance by corporate officials of social responsibility, other than to make as much money for the stockholders as they possibly can. That was Milton Friedman, who was Noel Welch, a world-famous economist. Bottom line is, ethics, so Jews exist to do business. Corporations exist to make money. So if we climb Jacob's ladder by doing business, we climb the corporate ladder by making money for the company. That's how you climb the corporate ladder. Now, ethics is a constraint. You have to climb the corporate ladder in such a way that you don't get arrested or thrown in jail. But it's all about making money. Putting all this together is you make money subject to the constraint of ethical behavior. Also, unethical business practices are frequently illegal. So David Thompson means this when he says that acting with integrity is not only good policy, it is good business. He means it. It is. Especially if you don't act with integrity, the government finds out about it and gets whacked with $1 million fines, and it's bad news. But he will reassign or fire someone if their business areas are losing money, irrespective of how ethical he or she is being. That's the bottom line. You're there to make money. You get promoted when you make money. You don't get promoted if you don't make money. You make money, everybody can. Making money is the goal. You go into the corporate world, making money is as you can substitute making money from doing business. Right? They feel about making money the same way. This makes money. It's good. And in the corporate world, it is good. Right? Okay. So now I just want to spend a little bit of time talking about Orbital and giving you a little bit of context about the environment in which I work. I'll do this very quickly. I'm not trying to recruit anybody, and as far as I know, nobody here is a customer, and everything here is on the up and up. I don't have to worry about non-disclosures or anything. I'm not revealing any company proprietary information. So we make spacecraft and we make launch vehicles. We build rockets, and we build rockets out west, and then we build the payloads for those rockets, the satellites. Satellites are called spacecraft. Rockets are called launch vehicles. We build satellites. We build a number of different kinds of satellites, mostly small to medium satellites. Our big competitors are Boeing, Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman. They have a very large satellite business, large in terms of volume and size, but they also compete in the mid and small satellite areas, and we serve customers in the Department of Defense, National Security, Commercial, NASA, you name it. Those are our customers. We have over 1,000 satellites and launch vehicles built. We have a pretty good track record, about 4,000 employees. The company has revenues about $1.5 billion. That's how much money the company actually makes. That's how much cash comes in the door. And then there is a backlog, which means that under contract to make more money, that's about four times as much as that. And then, you know, David Thompson wants everybody to say we have a conservative balance sheet, which is strong liquidity. That means that we have real cash in the bank. Okay, next slide. So the facilities are in Dulles, Virginia, and that's where I work, and my office is in this building over there. But there are also a facility in Chandler, Arizona. That's where they build launch vehicles. Recently acquired a facility in Gilbert, Arizona. And then Greenbelt, there's a facility that basically provides technical support for that. We have a lot of satellites, commercial satellites, which basically private companies build in order to affect communications, worldwide communications. We build satellites for the government. We have all sorts of payloads, interceptor vehicles, space launch vehicles, that's the Pegasus that you see in the lower right-hand corner, lower left-hand corner. That's a launch vehicle that rides along the underbelly of a big plane, and then the plane takes off, and then the rocket drops from the belly of the plane, and then goes off into space. Okay, next chart. Okay. So I just want to give you a sense of what I do. This is something from NASA, which is called technology readiness level. This is where you go ahead and bin the state of maturity of a given technology. So if somebody has an idea to go ahead and they want to build an anti-gravity machine, and they're sitting and talking, let's build an anti-gravity machine. So that would be TRL level one, because all we're doing is thinking about it. We haven't done any demonstration, haven't built any hardware, haven't shown even a proof of principle on a simple level. And then the TRL levels mature until you eventually get to TRL level six, which for some reason is whited out, where you actually have a prototype demonstration of this concept. And then it goes up in space to TRL level seven. You actually fly it in space here. You do a lab demonstration, you fly it in space, and off you go. Now, these are very important characterization levels of a very important taxonomy, because number one, the government has different buckets of money for each of those TRL levels to fund research and development. That's very important. And also it's very important because the government will, because it has different buckets of money, when the government issues solicitations, it will say, we are looking for something TRL level one to TRL level three. Or the government will say, we are looking for something that has proven components TRL level seven and above. So you know exactly what kind of program you're dealing with. Next chapter. Okay. So now we're coming to what I do, and I in the interest of I don't know if anybody here is a foreign national. If you're a foreign national, part of my business ethics means that I would have to go through my ITAR office, the International Traffic and Arms Regulation, and I would have to get permission to show this presentation to you. So what I did was I made sure that there was nothing in this presentation that could possibly trigger any sort of ITAR oversight, and that's why I put a big blue box there saying very interesting. I don't care if you know that I do very interesting and innovative work. But the point of this is what my laboratory does is it takes things basically from TRL level one, where somebody will come up with a really interesting and exciting idea, and then we will go to the customer, either we will fund this money internally, that's what internal funding, or we'll go to a customer and the customer will say, that's a great idea, here's $500,000, I want you to do a little study to go ahead and flesh it out. And then we'll flesh it out until the point where we actually can get maybe a $20 million program or so, to actually, over the course of 3 or 4 years, to actually build a prototype. And then after the prototype is built, then what we would like to do is to put it up in space. And we put it up in space and demonstrate it, and show that it works in a space environment, which is much more hostile than a terrestrial environment, because space has problems with radiation. So if you go ahead and take your laptop, sometimes you can actually take your laptop on an airplane, and it won't work as well on an airplane. And the reason it's not working so well on an airplane is because there's radiation that comes from the airplane that's interfering with your microprocessor. So you go ahead and you take the processor and put it up in low Earth orbit, it's going to get wiped, and it has the possibility of getting wiped. So, okay, post the table. And then what we do is we turn it over to the operational business. So if I've demonstrated a technology, I show that it's space-worthy, I make ones and twosies, we built our anti-gravity machine, or whatever it did, or our energy ray, where we beam power from space and can power the whole planet, and everybody's happy, then we go and find a different pot of money, and I give it over to the other business units at Orbital, which are basically in business to build hundreds of them, not onesies or twosies, and then the company has a product line and it makes money. This is the most important thing. My whole justification for doing all this technology development is the same justification for doing effort. And that is that the company will smile at these new concepts. The company will smile at science and technology development, provided that the bottom line is that it's going to get a competitive edge over Boeing, Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, and that we'll win big money contracts. The CEO has no patience for anything that we do that doesn't result in a bottom line. Okay, so this is this is my organization. I have about 40 people, 40 engineers who work for me, and it's right now it's about a $20 million a business, which is a small business. It's not a big business. It sounds like a lot of money, but it's really not a lot of money. It's not a small business like you qualify for small business, you know, initiative, but in a great grand scheme. Okay. All right, my responsibilities include all of the things that are on that chart, and then compliance with company ethical policies and practices. So, for example, there was a situation that came up last week where an employee came to me and said that my supervisor, there's something that had to be inspected by a certain time. And if it wasn't inspected by a certain date, then somebody had to go ahead and write a form and submit it. And so the employee came to me and said, you know, this guy went ahead and wanted me to backdate. He wanted a witness. He needed to have two people sign a sheet. And he went ahead and backdated the inspection so he wouldn't have to go ahead and do this extra paperwork. He backdated it to September. What do I do? So I said, well, this has a number of different levels. You know, there's your walk in the woods, what you do, there's a personal issue and how you deal with your sense of balance. I'm not going to tell you about that, but I do have to tell you as the lab director, what you have to do is talk to this guy's supervisor, bring it to the person's supervisor, and get everything out in the open, and make sure that you're on the up and up, because you could get blamed by this, everybody could get blamed by this, and the government, whoever would find out that this was being done, would be a disaster. So just miss it. Okay? And then the other thing is, you want to be the kind of manager, be the kind of parent, be the kind of rabbi, be the kind of human being that people seek out, not avoid, when they have the problem. So when people have a problem, you don't want to scream at them because they have a problem. You want to help them solve the problem. Okay. So this is actually something that from the Orbital website. This is part of the ethics training. And you know, ethics study is good and right, and everybody has to read these, and there's about 30 charts, and it goes through all these different scenarios, and some of them have videos where they show people dealing with some great ethical issue, and then you have to answer it right. But in 1983, the Wall Street Journal called business ethics an oxymoron, right? Meaning that they're a fundamental contradiction in terms. But that's not the case now. Too many people have gone to jail, and now people take it really seriously. So why should you care? And this is actually again part of the training that we get. True story, 7 workers at a nuclear waste storage site were laid off, and they refused to install the valve, even if it meant defying company orders. The valve was dangerous, it caused radioactive fluid to leak out. The workers put their jobs on the line for the greater good, and in the process they did it to turn a potential disaster into a lesson in ethics. Now, of course, if you do that, there is a whistleblower protection. That if you see something that's going on at the company that's not going well and it's not the right thing, there is a hotline that you call. And you're supposed to talk to your supervisor. If your supervisor doesn't respond, there is an ethics hotline. And it goes right to, you know, execution officers that will come down and fix the problem. And I will mention that the ethics hotline can be something that can be abused, and it has been abused. There was an instance where there was a disgruntled employee, and the ethics hotline can be submitted, your complaint can be submitted anonymously. And there was a situation where there was a disgruntled employee who called the ethics hotline and accused Orbital of going ahead and buying parts at Radio Shack, so to speak, commercial parts that were not space qualified for inclusion in government satellites instead of going and spending, you know, the extra money to go ahead and get space qualified parts. And in response to that, my boss told me that this happened about 12, 13 years ago. My boss was sitting at his workstation, and an FBI agent came in with a flak jacket and said, "Get your hands off the keyboard." And they went ahead, and they wanted to go ahead and make Orbital an example of this kind of practice. And everybody, you know, basically had to stick against the all their hands off their keyboards. They went ahead and confiscated all of the computers in real time. Nobody had a chance to close any applications on, and they went ahead and conducted an analysis, an investigation. It turns out they found nothing, right? It was a disgruntled employee going ahead and getting back at Orbital and putting in a complaint. So, you know, all of these situations have a price to pay. And in fact, when you want to know why screwdrivers cost $500 or hammers cost $750 when you go to Home Depot, part of the reason they cost so much money is because there is so much oversight involved in the requisition and acquisition process to make sure that nobody is cheating. And so there is such formalism in terms of the process. Do we need a hammer? Does it have to be this kind of hammer? Who should we do it? Who's the contract? Who's watching the contract? So on and so forth. So Orbital has an ethics and compliance program, and these are all part of our formal training. We all have to know this. They're written code. We have to get tested in the code. They're tested. So on and so forth. Next slide. So then there is a code of ethics, and these are the things that we have to know about. Negotiation and performance of contracts. When you go ahead and bid a contract with the government, you have to go ahead and certify that your prices are real. You can't go ahead and tell the government just because Lockheed Martin is bidding for a rocket and it's going to cost $200 million and you want the contract, you can't just suddenly say, well, we can build it for you for $100 million and lie about how long it will take and how many people it will take to build it and this and that. You can't do that. That's a lie. You have to go through a very, very rigorous process where all of your processes, all of your costs, all of your estimates are vetted. Business courtesy. Somebody comes, right? You go to, oftentimes you go to these conferences if you're working for the government. There's nothing more than a contractor would like to do to get a government person in their pocket, right? Literally and figuratively. Nothing would be greater, right? And the greater good. You have a customer who loves you, take the customer out to dinner, buy the customer this, buy the customer that, do this and do that. So from the government side, all the people working in the government get whacked because they have to get trained in what they can and cannot accept. Below $5 is okay, above $5 is not okay, it's this issue, that issue, and we have to be very clear. Whenever we have a meeting with the government, we have to stand up and say, there is a button, lunch is being served. You can put the cost of lunch is $8.50, and there is a Boy Scout box, you know, there is a good Scout box over in the corner, and we expect you to go ahead and put your $8.50 in that box and reimburse the cost. Right? We have to say that to people. And working with former government officials, I'm going to talk about that, labor and charging. I'm going to show you that too. There's conflict of interest, complete accurate and timely disclosure. And my English name is Richard. Don't ask me why, Richard and Yosef, but that's something you can take up with my mother and father. I love Michelle. But this was an email that I got just this past week, again, reminding me of how important ethics training is and that it's time for me to go ahead and go online and do another round of ethics training. So they take it very seriously. Okay, next time. Okay, I just wanted to give you a sense of a timesheet. My time, these are all represent different contracts and the numbers of the projects are different contracts. It is illegal. Let's say one contract is overrunning. There's no more money in this contract, but there's lots of money in this contract. So the patient will be saying, okay, you know, I need to do a lot of work in this contract which doesn't have very much money, right? So you know what I'll do? I'll go ahead and charge my time to this other contract. That has lots of money, right? And that way there's no overruns and I'm not going to get yelled at by accounting, why are you charging for the contract, you're overrunning, there's no more money, blah, 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 blah. If I do that, that's illegal. That is illegal. This is a legal document. And when I go ahead and I sign this document at the end of every 2 weeks and submit these charges, right, this is a legal document. I have charged this number of hours to this contract and not a penny more. And I am on the up and up, and it's straight. And that's how they do all the accounting. Darlene Drury, this is a great case. I'll go through this case. When I was in the government, she was the bane of my existence. For 10 years, there was a woman named Darlene Drury who decided decided, she worked for the Air Force, she decided how much the Air Force would pay for bombers, fighters, and missiles. And the Air Force buys more stuff than any other service. And they buy expensive stuff. And she had a budget that was bigger than the entire Department of Homeland Security. That, and she had the power. And even though she had people who were political appointees who oversaw her work, she was a career FDF, and she would tell the political appointees, you're going to come and you're going to go, but I'm here forever, so you be quiet and you listen to me because I know how to go ahead and run the show. And she was a terror. And she had a reputation for toughness. She was known as the Dragon. Right? She was a very tough. She was among maybe the most powerful woman in Washington. Second most powerful woman in Washington. She, you wanted to know, you wanted to buy a plane, you wanted to buy a fleet of planes, you had to go through her. Okay. So in 2000, she sent the resumes of her daughter, a recent college graduate, and her daughter's fiance, a published PhD in aeronautical engineering, to Boeing, and both were hired. At the time, that was completely legal. That is no longer completely legal. But at the time, that was legal. And by the way, the laws that are associated with the Department of Defense and the laws that are associated with members of Congress are very, very different. There is no, as yet, conflict of interest clause. Congressmen can go ahead and solicit a job from a business, and it's not illegal. But it is illegal for someone who's in the Department of Defense to have oversight of contracts to go and solicit a business post-government career with that company and with those contractors with whom they have business. Okay, so it was a conflict of interest, but it wasn't illegal. Then she went ahead and got a job with Boeing for $250,000 a year with a $50,000 bonus. Not bad. Okay, clearly a conflict of interest, but again, ostensibly not illegal. She orchestrated a deal. Now this is the illegal part. She orchestrated a deal while she was still in the Pentagon, knowing full well that she was going to go to Boeing. She orchestrated a deal where the Air Force would agree to lease 20 and purchase 80 KC-737 tankers from Boeing for a total price of $26 billion, or $260 million per plane, though buying one KC-37 outright, one at a time, only cost $150 million. So she was making a whole lot of money for her new company. She was using her office in the Air Force to make a pile of money for her new company. That is what she did. Well, she was caught. She went to jail. She served a 9-month sentence. And that's her, in case you run into her. And as a result of that, if you go to the next chart, when a person gets hired, at one time I was looking for a job at Northrop Grumman. You probably can't see that, but there are checks over here. And Northrop Grumman, before I even applied, says, I am not supervising anyone who is participating personally or substantially in any federal agency procurement in which Northrop Grumman is involved. Right? I'm applying to you, Northrop Grumman, for a job, and I attest to the fact I have nothing to do with Northrop Grumman. Here is a box, I do have something to do with Northrop Grumman. And what that means is, no job. Right? Check that box, you don't get a job. This over here is the same thing. This is another contract. My government duties and responsibilities have nothing to do with Northrop Grumman. And I get a job. Or at least I can submit my application. Here, no job. I used to work for the Pentagon. And then, of course, you have the DOD questionnaire for departing personnel. And you have to fill out this whole questionnaire. Where are you going? What are you doing? Who are you oversight? And you meet with DOD counsel to make sure that who you are going to work for has nothing to do with what you've done in DOD. And then there is a statute where a person is prohibited from having anything to do with their agency for a certain period of time, irrespective of who or what's involved. And then there are statutes where a lifetime prohibition are involved. So this is very serious business. Okay, next slide. All right, this is just, I'm just moving along. I'm skipping some things. There's more. But okay, besides going through all the ethics and negotiations and honesty and contracts, there's other aspects to ethics. And this is a very interesting thing.
it's almost as if the business world is starting to learn the halachas of Yichud. Because if you go ahead and you start seeing some of the ramifications that are associated, you know, there is no, be very careful, never touch a female, right? It's not appropriate. You really should be careful being alone with a female, being alone if you're a male, a member of the opposite sex, and so on and so forth. And there was a guy over here, his name is Fred, I changed his name to protect the innocent. He was a nice guy, very, very nice fellow, a southerner. I think he was even a minister. And he was working at Orbital, and he was just an old southern kind of country gentleman, and he would see young ladies, and he would call them darling, right? And then he would go over and say, "How you doing, darling?" And then walk over to them and give them a nice kiss on the cheek. And some of the darlings they didn't like it that much. And it's interesting the way that the politics works is that Fred got somebody else angry, and the person that he got angry wanted Fred out of there anyway. And then the person observed that Fred was kissing, the darling and kissing some of the admins and so on and so forth. And then basically got Fred thrown out of the company because he built a case where Fred was basically fired for sexual harassment. Okay? And then it's not just lots of ways of aggravating people. What's a hostile environment, gender harassment, sexual harassment, racial harassment, religious harassment, age harassment. Just think of all the ways you can aggravate somebody. And there is a course, where we really try. And in fact, I'll also mention over here that one of the things that I was having trouble with in one of the training things was there was a scenario where somebody was in a motorcycle accident. This was the scenario. It was a staged issue. Somebody was in a motorcycle accident, and somebody from the office was a good friend of them, and they were an employee of the company, and the motorcycle, they're recuperating. Let's raise money, right, and buy this person a gift who got in this motorcycle. So, not so fast, right, because what happens if I feel pressured that I have to give money to this guy who was in a motorcycle accident? You're pressuring me. I don't know this person. Is it really voluntary? Maybe it's not voluntary. And so there's a whole bunch of training, right, that I still can't quite figure out, like how you're supposed to deal with someone who's in a motorcycle accident and want to help them out a little bit. So we have something where we just, it's almost like Mahavir, inviting someone to a bridge, It says, the person was in a motorcycle accident, and there's a pusher, in this room. And that's it. And then if you want to figure out, to put the money in the pusher to make, that's good for you. But you can't go to somebody and say, I want you to please give $10 to this person, or a baby gift. If there's somebody who had a baby, you want to buy a baby gift. It's the same thing. You can't dodge. You can go ahead and collect money for the baby gift. Well, I don't like this person. I don't want to be socially ostracized, because I don't want to give this person. That's the same. Okay. All right, so there's a lot of things that I covered, and a lot of things I didn't cover. But I want to thank you. So basically, in keeping with the dictum of telling people what you're going to tell them, telling them what you told them. That's it. So we went over some halakhic issues. We went over the confluence of Torah values and Jewish ethics. We went through a bifurcation of Torah values and business ethics. And then I tried to give you a little bit of flavor of what ethics looks like from a money-making ethic. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Singer. It was a great education. How many days sounds like a state of being a
I think it's a
state of being a state. I'd like to thank everybody. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. There are questions outside. Please help yourself if anybody wants to ask questions to Rabbi Singer.
Make yourself available.
Yeah.